Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. You know, since its outbreak in Latin America in early 2015, the Zika virus has mostly affected people outside America's borders. But with four cases of the virus discovered in the North Miami neighborhood of Wynwood, bringing Florida's Zika infections to 14, yesterday the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advised pregnant women not to travel to Wynwood. This is the first time the CDC has warned people not to travel to an area within the United States. The announcement has already had an impact on tourism, with travel agencies reporting cancellations for trips to Florida. According to the New York Times, the airline JetBlue said in a statement that it would allow refunds for people with, quote, concerns of traveling to Zika-impacted areas confirmed by the CDC, unquote. We have a statement from Mayor de Blasio and his health commissioner that came yesterday. Quote, following the confirmation by the Florida Health Department of 10 cases of locally transmitted Zika virus in one area of Miami, Florida, New York City's health department is updating its current travel warning for Latin America and the Caribbean to include this area of Miami. The fact that Zika is spreading locally in this Miami neighborhood means that pregnant women, women trying to conceive, and their sexual partners put themselves and their unborn child at risk of potential Zika infection when visiting this area. So the mayor's office put that out. And then there's what's going on in Puerto Rico, part of the United States, which is much worse than in Florida. So joining us now to discuss the Zika situation domestically is Dr. Ian Lipkin, the director of the Columbia University Mailman School Center for Infection and Immunity. Welcome to WNYC, Dr. Lipkin.
Good morning, Brian.
And listeners, if you have any Zika questions, we can take them at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Let me start by asking you the question that Richard Hake was musing on during the newscast. How is it that an infection or infestation, I should say, could be confined to one neighborhood of a city, like they're saying Zika is in the Wynwood area of Miami per se?
Well, all we really know is the number of cases that have emerged thus far are located in that area. That's not to say that the virus is contained to that area. That simply means that this is the area where we know already that we have risk.
And so what should people think beyond the official statements from the government, like the city of New York or the CDC, where they have reason to be cautious in what they say, both to caution people, you know, for the sake of their health and also not to cause a panic and an overreaction and be cautious in that way? Would you say people shouldn't go to Miami at all? Is it safe to assume that if you don't go to Wynwood, you're going to be pretty much at low risk for Zika?
Boy, I wish I had a crystal ball and I could give you that sort of information. On the fly, the bottom line is that we know that there are these cases in this particular area. I would imagine that the probability is high that there are other infected areas. There are other areas where there are infected mosquitoes, and this is something which the Florida Department of Health is going to have to monitor very closely. The other thing, of course, is to be concerned about is that all it takes is a few infected individuals to move into an area where you have a mosquito that's capable of transmitting infection to set up a new center. And these particular mosquitoes, the Aedes mosquitoes, you know, have a fairly broad host range throughout the southern United States, but going up even into Delaware and New Jersey. So this is a problem for all of us, and we need to find a way to address it.
Do you think it's a mistake for JetBlue to give refunds to concerned travelers, even those who aren't visiting this specific neighborhood in Wynwood? I mean, how do they know if their customers traveling? I don't even think JetBlue goes to Miami, to tell you the truth. I think they go elsewhere in South Florida. So what would that be about?
I mean, it's a decision that they've made, presumably based on a consideration of public health and a business model. I think it's quite generous to do that because, you know, there's a potentially very, very large area in which you could have these infected mosquitoes. Now, you know, the good news, if there is any good news about this, is that, you know, as we see more and more people becoming infected who are not pregnant and presumably becoming immune, the number of people who are at risk who might become pregnant, you know, subsequent to the season is going to continue to drop. So while we don't yet have a vaccine, we have a sort of a natural experiment, right, if you will, mm-hmm. with vaccination by exposing people to Zika. But it is a huge risk. There have been individuals who are trying to project what's going to happen with this particular outbreak and trying to make predictions about whether or not Zika is going to be with us for many, many years or just a few. And there are some people who think that this virus is going to move through the population over a period of, you know, 2 to 3 years. Most people will become immune to it, and we won't see this big burden of Zika-associated disease. That said, there are many people who are infected now, and we are going to have these babies with microcephaly and perhaps even other forms of neurological impairment that are going to be problems for us, you know, for the rest of their lives. They're going to have to be supported.
And that's the main risk. Maybe it's worth going over the medical risks again. Like, why should people be so afraid of getting this virus?
Yes, the major risk is not so much to your average adult. It really is to pregnant women and their offspring. And it appears as though the risk is considerable. We don't actually know how high the risk is yet, because the prospective studies that you need to assess that haven't been done. They're now being pursued in South America, and I imagine we'll start doing them in Florida as well, so we can get some ideas to, you know, what is the associated risk if a woman is pregnant at this point in time and that point in time. And, you know, we're also going to have to see what we begin to see beyond the microcephaly. That may be the tip of the iceberg. With microcephaly, it's fairly obvious because, you know, the size of the baby's head is small. But there's some evidence now that's beginning to come out that suggests that even if you don't meet the full criteria for microcephaly, the heads of babies born to mothers who are known to have had a Zika infection may be somewhat smaller, and there may be an impact on behavior and cognitive function. So this is really, it's a real challenge for public health. It's an enormous risk.
Dr. Ian Lipkin with us from the Columbia University Mailman School Center for Infection and Immunity. And Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question is, if a young girl gets the Zika virus and is infected by the virus and overcomes whatever the symptoms are, is she in jeopardy later in life when she decides to have children? Does the virus potentially rear its head then?
So let me repeat the question. So the question, as I understand it, is you want to know that if a girl is infected with Zika virus, recovers from the infection, and she were to become pregnant years downstream, for example, would there be any risk that that child might be somehow affected by the earlier infection with Zika?
That is the question,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so that, in fact, that you could even think of that girl as having been immunized against Zika virus infection. She or that child would not be at increased risk for microcephaly or any other sorts of disorders associated with it. If the virus is not there and actively infecting the mother during the course of the pregnancy, there isn't any risk.
How about a guy who gets it because I gather it can be sexually transmitted? Does the virus then continue to live on within him? Like HIV, once you have it, and you can sexually transmit, right? So this is a different acting virus from that, or is it in the case of males?
So it's not like HIV in the sense that you don't have persistent viral infection for the lifetime of the individual. There are only very rare cases where people really cure HIV infection. You know, you can count those, you know, very, very easily. But there is a period of time when men can continue to express virus, to have active virus shed in their semen, in their sperm. And that has been measured out as far as 3 months. So during that period of time, if a man, for example, goes to an area where he becomes infected, there is a concern that, you know, he should be using either, you know, condoms or should be avoiding sexual intercourse with anybody to who might be susceptible. So this is a risk, and as I say, it looks to us as though the risk is approximately 3 months that a man may continue to have virus active in his semen.
Paula on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paula.
Hi. When I was pregnant, I had to get a test for toxoplasmosis because I was around cats a lot, and it did say that I had exposure. And I'm wondering if there's something that women can do, or even men at this point, since they can transmit it, to see if they've been exposed. I know Zika's sort of new, but maybe it's mutated and it's always been around. Is there a test that people can have to tell them whether they've had previous exposure?
Well, those are all very good questions, and unfortunately, the answers are not quite as clear as we'd like them to be. There are tests that you can take that measure antibodies, which indicate the fact that at some point during the course of your life, you've been exposed to a virus or a bacterium. The challenge with Zika, however, is that the virus is so similar to other viruses, chiefly dengue virus is the one that's our biggest confound, that we can't readily distinguish antibodies to Zika from antibodies to dengue. And dengue virus, which has also appeared in Florida and is present in throughout South America and Central America, is very difficult to distinguish from Zika. Now, if you have a molecular test, right, which detects the presence of the active virus at the time that it's growing inside your body, this we can do quite readily. We can tell you whether or not you've had Zika virus infection. But if we look, say, a month down the line, and we're using antibodies, we're only just now beginning to develop tests that are sufficiently specific to tell you whether or not you've been exposed to Zika or dengue or neither.
Okay. So that might be something that's in the works, though.
It is in the works. It's something, for example, that we're working on around the clock at Columbia because we realize this is a critical issue because it does enable women to, because many of the women who've subsequently given birth to children who've had microcephaly don't have active virus at the time that, you know, they give birth. So we're relying upon these antibody tests to make the link between Zika virus infection and the outcome.
Thank you for your call, Paul. Can you talk about Puerto Rico? Because for all the discussion that we're having about 14 cases in one neighborhood in Miami, I gather there are more than 5,000 confirmed infections in Puerto Rico, including more than 600 of pregnant women?
That's correct, and it's a staggering burden. And in fact, the last numbers I've seen have been over 5,500 confirmed infections, and something like close to 700 women who've tested positive. A third of those women were asymptomatic. So, you know, it's not you can't rule out Zika virus infection just because you don't have symptoms, you don't have rash, you don't have fever. And this is why we think that, you know, that all these women should be screened using antibody tests as soon as we have this good antibody test to offer. The estimates from the CDC suggest that up to 25% of the population in Puerto Rico will have been infected by Zika by the end of the year, and that's approximately 10,000 pregnancies. So this is going to be, you know, a huge challenge, even if only a very small percentage of the women who become infected with Zika have a child who's born with microcephaly. The good news, as I said earlier, is that if this virus moves through the population this rapidly, most people have asymptomatic disease or infected before they're pregnant or don't transmit it, then they will be immune to Zika virus infection and they will not be able to pass this on to the fetus.
Carol in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hello. I understand and appreciate the concern around microcephaly in pregnant women, but I'm wondering why the possibility of contracting Guillain-Barré has been dropped from the conversation, when that is certainly a horrible illness that could affect anyone in the population, not just pregnant women.
And Dr. Lipkin, that is another Zika risk, right?
Yes, that is another Zika risk, and having cared for patients with Guillain-Barré syndrome, I agree with you. It is a, you know, it's a terrible condition, and it's life-threatening. And the reason people are focusing on the microcephaly is because with microcephaly, we're concerned about something which will have an impact lifelong, and the numbers appear to be so much larger than for Guillain-Barré. But you're absolutely correct. Guillain-Barré is a concern.
And I'm glad you pointed it out. Does that mean that the warning, to the extent that there is a travel warning, and again, the warning is not don't travel to Miami or anything broader than that. The warning is don't travel to the Wynwood neighborhood of Miami where they found these individual cases. But why wouldn't it be more general than the way we are hearing it articulated, which is basically for pregnant women or women who think they may become pregnant soon or the potential sexual partners of women who may become pregnant soon?
I think that you can make a very strong argument for what you're suggesting, Brian, is that this should be a much broader recommendation to avoid certain, you know, to avoid travel to areas where we may not yet have reports of Zika virus infection, but we anticipate that we could.
My question is really different than that. It's that regardless of what the area is, the geographical area, why isn't it more generalized than for people in the, you know, in the pregnancy or potentially pregnant category, given the Guillain-Barré risk?
I think the Guillain-Barré risk is actually very small. And it's not as clear-cut as what's been described for microcephaly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are cases of Guillain-Barré that occur, you know, year-round that may or may not be associated with previous viral infections, and it's very difficult to protect against those. The other thing with Guillain-Barré syndrome is that we do have ways in which we can treat people with Guillain-Barré. We can maintain their respiratory function. We can give them intravenous gamma globulins that reduce the damage to the nervous system, whereas with the microcephaly, we don't have any options at present to reduce the risk or to address the problem once the damage is done.
Officials have been quoted saying many residents of Puerto Rico fail to protect themselves against bites because they believe the threat is exaggerated. What should residents be doing to protect themselves?
Well, you know, we have this problem with ticks and mosquitoes and other vectors of illness, you know, throughout the United States, throughout the world for that matter. Getting bitten by mosquitoes is always a risk. In those areas, particularly in the tropics where we have dengue and chikungunya, or now Zika virus, we need to wear insect repellents. I think this is important. That said, you know, there are people who are making the case that exposure to Zika virus until such time as we have a vaccine probably has some basis in protection against subsequent disease. Now, I'm not prescribing that myself, but I'm saying there are people who are making such arguments.
Louise in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Louise.
Hi, Brian. Forgive me if I'm repeating a question that I might have missed, but my son is leaving for Brazil for the Olympics on Friday, and I've advised him that he should be checked for the virus when he comes home because he may not have symptoms. I'd like to know if you think that's good advice, and also if his risk is greater or lesser when he goes into the Amazon, because he's doing that as well.
Well, the virus is circulating widely through South America, and it sounds like your son will be going to areas where he may become exposed to the virus. If he has a partner who he's intending to impregnate or may become pregnant, then this, I think, is a significant risk. And there are some specific guidelines that have been issued by the Center for Disease Control that you want to follow. But there is no way in which I think we would be able to tell you today that you're absolutely incapable of transmitting the virus if, in fact, you've gone into an area where there's been exposure. The fact that we don't find the virus in your blood does not exclude the possibility that it may be present in sperm. and there are not as yet any guidelines for how we can rigorously test sperm to make sure that there's no active virus. So there are recommendations about either avoiding sex or using condoms for a period of several months after you return from an area where you may have been exposed. Once we have better antibody tests that can specifically differentiate infection with dengue and Zika, we'll have a better handle on that risk.
Dr. Ian Lipkin, the director of the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health Center for Infection and Immunity, thank you for giving us so much good information and context about the Zika virus. I really, really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Brian.